Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm in the studio today with my co-host, Senator Dan McKay on the right.
Good morning, everyone.
And so happy to have Representative Brian King, the House Minority Leader, in the studio representing the left. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks. Good to be here.
I don't know if you noticed, but not too long ago when you were in the studio, I called you the House Majority Leader.
Well,
it just kind of slips off my tongue.
I mean, I don't have a problem with that. You don't have a problem with that, do you, Dan?
Nah, that'd be great, Brian. I don't know why I didn't think of that earlier.
I'm going to, normally we talk about national things first, but I'm going to jump right to the Salt Lake City mayoral election because it's such hot news this week, and I just want to hear what you guys are thinking. Of course, all the final numbers aren't in. There's some things that could still happen, but Aaron Mendenhall takes 23.7% of the votes as of the time of this taping. Jim DeBacchus in second at 21.56%. And Luz Escamilla, just, 100 votes, give or take?
109.
Behind.
As of our current recording. Although, by this afternoon, Thursday afternoon, the recorder will be updating.
So some things could move and whatnot.
Bunch of movement on Thursday.
How would you break this down, Dan? Like, were you surprised?
Absolutely. I mean, the upswing. Well, how about this? I will say, and I have talked to, there are several in my office who live up in the Parleys area or, you know, in the Avenues or Sugar House. And I was, you know, without tainting their thinking one way or the other, just asking them where they were thinking. And everybody's like, well, I know Jim DeBacchus, and I don't know any of the others. That's what I would hear persistently.
Name ID.
I would hear that early and often. And then as the election got closer, and even on the day of the election, the office sentiment was, boy, this Aaron Mendenhall seems really interesting. And honestly, it wasn't until that day that I thought, huh. Because usually my office is a pretty good litmus for where I would think the mayor's race turns out, and in this situation, that was true. And it caught me by surprise. It really was.
I sensed in the last 2-3 weeks some momentum building for Aaron. I don't know what, it's almost a gestalt, you know, it's hard to pin that down sometimes because nobody really knows. But I was surprised that she came out on top. It wouldn't have surprised me if you'd said to me, Jim's going to be on top and Aaron's going to be second in a close race with Luz.
Mm-hmm. But the fact that she's up there far and away above.
That was surprising to me. I think that for Dan and I, we know Jim well. Having served with him up the legislature, we know Luz well. I know Aaron, but not nearly as well. I think that one of the things that I was happy about as a resident of the city is to see these top six people. I look at Aaron and Jim and Luz and David Garbett and David Ibarra and Stan Penfold. Every one of those, I thought, I'd be happy to have them, any one of them, be the mayor because I think they're all well-qualified, sharp, smart people. But Aaron, I think, has a lot of charisma. She's got a very effective personal presence. To get to know Aaron it's hard not to like her. And she
Have
comes across well.
To not like her?
No, I haven't. Oh, okay. But, you know, all I'm saying, my friend, is that she's got some charisma. And I think that's a hard thing to measure in terms of how it translates to votes. But it's important.
I kept finding myself in situations. I do not live in Salt Lake City, but I work most of the time in Salt Lake City. And I kept finding myself in situations where business leaders would say, who is this Aaron Mendenhall? She's impressing me, you know. And it was this kind of thing where I don't think she was well known outside of the city council kind of club, maybe in the area she represents. But as people got to see her, they liked her more and more.
Yeah.
And maybe it's this mix of, you know, progressive policies, pragmatic solutions, and very, as you said, a very warm personal presence.
Yeah, I think she's definitely got the edge going into the general election, regardless of whether it's Luz or Jim who comes through, simply because I think Jim is very charismatic himself, but he's also well established as being a lefty. And I think that there are going to be plenty of lefties that vote for Jim DeBacchus. He's not going to have a problem having his base of support turn out and vote for him. But I think there are a lot of people who are more moderate, more pragmatic, and more conservative, and they're probably not going to as quickly gravitate to him as opposed to whoever's running against him, whether it's Luz or Aaron.
Dan, speaking from a legislative point of view, what happens next for some of these candidates? So let's say Luz doesn't surpass Jim and so doesn't make it through to the final. What changes for her? She still will be a legislator?
Yep. Nothing changes. Honestly, she gets to continue being an effective advocate of the state for her district.
I mean, I wonder if that penalized her just a bit, you know, that you like having her up there.
Yeah, maybe. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think maybe people do that. I've rarely thought that way. I've always tried to just say who's best for the job.
What do the two of you think happens next with David Garbett? He was incredibly articulate.
He goes back to work for SUA.
Yeah, well,
he's not with them anymore, just for the record.
SUA distract value from the state, basically ruin all things great and small.
Mr. Anti-Public Lands over here.
I have a theory that when you run for office, it always turns out for the better, win or lose.
No, yeah. I think that's true. I think
you
that's true.
You just show something about yourself, and people get to know you, and opportunities come your way. So I would do so. That even with Stan Penfold, mark my words, he's going to have a place in the Aaron Mendenhall administration.
I hope so. I think that the whoever is elected the mayor would do well by putting Stan Penfold in. He's shown his qualifications and his competence, and he's well liked. And there may be others who ran that would qualify or want to be a part of a new administration or the new mayor would want to include. So I think that David is going to continue to be involved in the Pioneer Park Coalition. He's done that in the past. Mm-hmm. He's strong into environmental issues that he cares about very much. So I agree. He's young. He's bright. He's promising. I hope he continues to make a good impact here in Salt Lake and sticks around.
Dan, I don't know if Brian was in the studio or listened to the program, but someone once said that we will know who the gubernatorial candidate is on the left
once the
primary for Salt Lake City mayor's race is over. Yeah. Do you see any of these folks that aren't advancing as being on the ticket?
All of them.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
See, I don't think Stan doing that.
No, I could see Goldberger for sure. I mean, look, this
so
party.
Goldberger, 250
that
votes.
That party is so
Dan,
lost in the freaking ocean.
I think Garbett could do that.
Well, I think I think Ibarra could do that. I think that David is, you look at David Ibarra's story. It's a remarkable success story.
Yeah.
When you find out what he went through to get where he is.
He was a foster child.
Yeah. And his brother, you talk about pulling yourself up by the bootstraps. They've done it. They can allege as much as anybody to have done it to do it. So I would love to see David continue to be involved in the political front. But here's the thing. David isn't a politician. I mean, he chose to run because he wanted to give back.
He loves the city.
He loves the city.
And he's a great leader.
Yeah.
And he wanted to put those skills to work.
Right. Yeah. And I think he's enjoyed the campaign. But quite honestly, it's not like he's out. I mean, some people run and you look at them and you think they have a burning desire to be elected to something and to serve in that position. I'm not sure that's David.
Yeah. Hmm. Dan, any other feelings on the governor's race and these candidates?
Well, you know, it could be any of these, or it could be a number of others. You know, I'm not excluding Brian King from that proposal yet.
A lot of people are not.
My name keeps coming up on this program for no reason that I can see.
We're all trying to get you out of the legislature.
Well, that's what I don't like about it, is I wish that he could do both.
Yeah. No, that's
it just doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Well. So, it will be interesting to see who the Democrats decide should lose in 2020.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see. No, Dan is being brutally honest. And that is, I think for really well-qualified Democrats to be interested in running, it's tough because it's really an uphill battle. And when you look at who's going to be in all likelihood on the Republican side, you've got some strong, well-qualified candidates who have a big base of support, who have a lot of experience.
Well, and isn't it interesting because the time is just compressing in my judgment. So summer's pretty much over. We're getting to late August. And usually you have to have announced your candidacy between like May and October.
Yeah.
Am I getting that about right?
Certainly by the end of the year.
Okay. So we have...
he's trying to give the Democrat just
a
little bit more time.
So we have Spencer Cox that's been carrying all the media all summer long, touring all over Utah. But the prevailing wisdom is that Hughes will enter the race by late August. But then you got former Governor Huntsman.
Well, and you saw the polls. I mean, you know, as we're talking about it, you saw the polls recently. You know, it said that 47% of the state of Utah would like to see Governor Huntsman run again. 47% of those polled. That is a huge number.
How do you think
without having campaigned?
How does it affect someone like Greg Hughes? He's a good friend of yours, Dan.
I don't know. I haven't talked to Greg about this other than Greg once told me when I asked him about this, he did tell me something will work out is basically, you know, if I had some of the conversation, something will work out.
He's going
don't
with
know
destiny.
What it is.
He's going with destiny.
Yeah, and something will work out. And honestly, I think Greg Hughes would be an amazing governor. He'd be a great lieutenant governor. He's just an asset to the state, and whoever wins, if it's not Greg Hughes, they ought to scoop him into their administration, and he ought to be part of it.
Well, he does want to serve, and I think Greg's got a good heart. He and I have a good relationship personally. I think the world of him. But I'll tell you something, Natalie. If John Huntsman chooses to step into this race, it's his to lose. He's got the money. He's got the name recognition. He looks great. He's articulate. He's got a record. Some people like it. Some people don't. It's mixed, I mean, according to who you are. But he has the ability to appeal to a lot of moderates and progressives even and get their votes.
Very
so
interesting.
So if it's Hughes versus Goldberger for the Democratic nomination.
That's too tough a choice.
What would you do, Brian?
Too tough a choice for me. just kidding. That was sarcastic.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner with Brian King and Dan McKay. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Dan McKay on the right.
And I'm Brian King on the left.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. We want to talk about some national news, and there's a lot of it. And I'm going to start with the stock market, Dan and Brian. Stock market showing some volatility. On Wednesday, what, did it have its largest drop of the year?
800 points or
something? Good heavens.
It'll be back by tomorrow.
I found myself in front of the Salt Lake Chamber Board of Governors. One of the things I do as an associate dean in the David X School of Business is present to the Board of Governors each month. I found myself sharing some economic data that wasn't too promising. So top of mind here, I don't want to talk economics because why would we do that? This is more of a public affairs political talk show. But let's just talk about the what ifs if this economy does start to slow down.
It will shape the 2020 election.
Yeah,
right?
I agree with that.
And it will come
consumer confidence starts to fall.
Yeah.
People start to
Well,
go to their bunkers.
I think what and I don't want to put words in Dan's mouth, but I think that what happens is you've got people who know how they feel about Donald Trump, and either like him or don't like him. But one of the things that he inarguably can say he's to some extent responsible for, rightly or wrongly, is how good the economy is. And so, you know, if the economy is not doing well, I think that you're going to see him go from 44% down to something well into the 30s or lower, depending on how bad the fall is. Because people aren't going to put up with his shenanigans unless and until the economy is doing well.
Well, yeah, maybe. But here's one question that the American people will be faced with in 2020. If the recession happens before the presidential election, the question will be, who do I believe will help me and my family get in a better financial position, right? And the question will be, can Donald Trump sell his business acumen and the ability to, you know, grow? And will the American people, bite into that? And if they do, more than the we're going to take care of you, we're going to provide you stuff, you're never going to be, you know, without. If it depends on how deep the recession is at that point as to whether or not people think it's a blip or a major change.
Let me paint a picture for both of you. Think of the next downturn as not being some single event, you know, like a financial crisis, a big asset bubble. But think of a no-deal Brexit in October.
Mm-hmm. Which is not going to be a good thing for the European economy. Much less,
and the European Union's a huge part of the global economy. Then the escalation of these trade wars, even though the tariffs were pushed off. But if we don't get the policy steps right there, this continued stock market volatility and how that affects consumer sentiment, business sentiment.
And here's the other thing.
The compounding of this combination of effects is what I fear.
This ties into the personality of Donald Trump, too, because I think it's hard to feel like you've got certainty or you've got predictability with Donald Trump. You simply don't. Mm-hmm. And a big part of that, of course, is his personality, because you don't know when he's going to flip and just completely change his tune on tariffs or on trade policy or on domestic issues that deal with the economy or the budget. I mean, he's unpredictable to the core.
Yeah.
And we
So uncertainty is another really hard thing for the
economy.
Yeah.
No, I think that the business community hates that. We heard that a lot. You know, I remember in the Obama administration hearing people say, yeah, but there's so much uncertainty. And they lay that at the feet of Obama and said that was his problem, is that we didn't have certainty. You certainly don't have certainty with Donald Trump. And that's what I'm hearing even from business people. People who were having a high tolerance for his unpredictability up to this point are now saying, hey, look, this tariff stuff in particular and the trade policies, it's just too mercurial for my comfort.
Yeah, for sure. Dan, we also got word in the last week about the Trump administration changing some of their immigration policies that really would have an adverse effect on poor immigrants. It prompted one of the, a person on NPR to comment. They played off the Emma Lazarus poem that's on the Statue of Liberty, and I think the quote is, "Give me your tired, your poor, who can stand on their own two feet and who will not become a public charge."
Mm. Was that bad?
Okay. This notion that our country represents, you know, the American dream.
Sure.
The ability to come together as a melting pot.
But doesn't that quote, melting pot, everything included, doesn't that quote highlight the fact that the United States potentially may not want to become the safety net for the nation? We're having a hard time providing a safety net for everyone inside the boundaries of the United States. And becoming a safety net for the world is increasingly difficult, and that's all I think.
But that mischaracterizes the empirical evidence about what immigrants contribute and how they contribute relative to non-immigrants.
They contribute a ton.
Well, and they do it at higher rates. They're more likely to be economically productive and successful. They're more likely to give more than they take. They're more likely to have less crime. They're more likely to make positive contributions, and that's empirically stating it. So I don't buy this idea that, you know, allowing more people to come in as immigrants from poor countries, whether it's Central or South America or elsewhere, is necessarily going to result in a degraded quality of life for Americans. It certainly won't result in a degraded quality of life for them. But I think that they will be contributors in a positive way to the rising seas and the boats of everyone being lifted.
Yeah, and you know, economically, you look at the shot in the arm that, you know, that immigration is going to have to play in the country for the foregoing future, right? I don't know about the stand on your own two feet. I don't know about that element, right? I think there's a balance between who comes and who doesn't come and who you allow and who doesn't.
And there definitely is.
But no one wants to have that conversation.
I just love our country representing the place where the tired, the poor, and the huddled masses can find, you know, opportunity.
Well, and the reality is, too, that contributes significantly to the reality that we have traditionally, historically, had really high rates of upward mobility in this country.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Socioeconomically, we have much more than other places in the world had people come here with nothing. And it would not, maybe not within their lifetimes, but certainly within the lifetimes of their children and grandchildren, join securely into the middle and upper socioeconomic categories of the country in a way that gave people hope. That's what, as
hope,
you were saying.
Hope's a great word there.
Yeah, and that's what you were saying, Natalie. That's
I
what
have
you
a gentleman I work with who is the first of 11 generations that hasn't been at war. Hmm. He's from Croatia.
Yeah.
And when his family came, it was through the asylum laws, and he made the comment to me, Natalie, nobody ever wants to be on that list seeking asylum. It is some combination of horrid events that
Natalie,
put him there.
I have one of my best employees as an associate lawyer from Bosnia.
Okay.
And she and her husband came over in the early aughts, or maybe it was the late 90s, and she begins to cry when she talks about this country. I mean, the opportunity that she's had from coming here is so integral to who she is and how she feels about this country. I am a huge believer in making sure. I'm not saying we should have open borders, but we got to have an immigration policy that's fixed and a lot better than the one we have now.
I just think the border openness, closeness, that kind of thing, it needs to be reflective of the economic need within the country.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, some point, you know, there may come a point where we need open borders. I don't know what that would
look
like.
Well, right now, you sure hear a lot of people in Utah, especially in rural Utah and other places, saying, well, I can't find qualified employees.
Yeah. So, you know, a more open border or whatever it might be. I just think there's a function
economically.
How about
just immigration reform that puts us in a place where people that are of goodwill, that, you know,
where's
can
that
pass
common sense
a criminal
solution?
Background check.
Yeah, but where's that common sense solution from anybody on the right or the left?
Yeah.
It is nowhere to be found.
Well, we got
including from any of the three Republicans or one Democratic member of Congress we have.
They might
Utah.
Be more inclined to do it when they see this labor shortage constraining job growth in our country.
We got close to it, and I think it was 2013 or 2014 when we had the Gang of Eight, the Republicans and Democrats coming together, and it stalled in the Senate. It was Mitch McConnell who said, I'm not going to do this.
Interesting. Hey, there's another thing. This is a way different topic, but Senator Steve Urquhart, former Senator Steve Urquhart, joined with a gal, I don't know this woman, Christine Stenquist.
Yeah, Christine was key to the truce and the marijuana initiative, Prop 2.
So they're proposing what? Something that will take on, they're calling it the Initiative Act. Is it statute they're looking for there,
well,
Brian?
I was actually talking to Steve about this just a couple of days ago, and what they'd love to have the legislature pass something, but they're not unrealistic about the prospect of that. So they're looking at the possibility of running an initiative that basically says, if an initiative is run and passes, any substantive changes that the legislature makes to that has to be brought back before people on the general election ballot and get the thumbs up.
And would
people.
They put this in the Constitution?
No, they would just pass it.
Can't.
You can't because any constitutional changes have to pass 2/3 of each chamber in the legislature
Period.
And then pass the people.
Got
so
it.
They're not thinking that's likely. But what they are thinking is that if you pass it as a statute, it's going to be something that is going to cause the legislature to think twice before they tamper substantively with an initiative that passes. And they're probably right about that, I think.
And if there's a legal problem to the initiative, it should just stay in place.
Well, that's this distinction
forever.
That I'm referring to about substantive changes versus technical changes.
And basically, Brian, what you are creating by calling it the substantive is you're creating the lawyer's full-time employment act.
Oh, well, no, listen, I'm with you in the sense that that's not a bright line.
Yeah. I'll say this. My son threw a baseball, hit the side of my car, left a dent in my car. I think he would argue as to whether or not it was substantive. I think it was substantive. You can see the analogy.
I can.
And I just say, I totally understand the way they're feeling. Again, and I've said this on the show before, I will say it till I'm blue in the face. Initiatives are little more than message bills. And they act like a billy club. And at the end of the day, they hit the legislature upside the head and say, hey, you're wrong on this. You should have a policy on it. That's what an initiative is. Because if you expect an initiative to be finely tuned, there's no amendments allowed. So as lawyers are reading through it and find all problems, which we did with Prop 2 in the medical marijuana initiative, there were substantive problems that were unenforceable and unenactable in the bill that violated not only local but federal law and a lot of other, you know, issues. And we could not have enacted Prop 2 the way it was. Now, there was a version that would say we just clean those things up, or there is another that says, hey, we do what we ended up doing. I'm just going to say the legislature felt the billy club upside the head, and they did something about it. It's not the way Truce and anybody else or, you know, Senator Urquhart, who's, you know, off his meds today, it's not his thing, right? I get it. But at the end of the day, people can go and they can have medical marijuana in the state of Utah and it will be available throughout the state. And tell me that wasn't the purpose of the initiative. Because I challenge any of our readers, go to our Facebook page, go to anybody else. Don't look online for any summaries. You tell me what's different between Prop 2 and what Utah has right now.
Yeah.
I wish we could say the same about Prop 3. I think you've got some elements of truth there about Prop 2, Dan. But Prop 3, we pretty much ignored the will of the people on that to a much greater extent.
Well, and this is
not we. You didn't.
Well, I certainly didn't. You did.
Yeah. But again, my district didn't vote for it.
Yeah. So something to keep an eye on, the Initiative Act. That's what it's called.
Yeah.
It's not worth watching. Because, again, it's going to beat the statute. And so right after it passes, before it's effective, a special session could certainly change.
Just throw it out.
See, Dan will not be saying initiatives or message bills. If on the basis of Prop 3 being modified substantively, the people in his district vote him out of office in 2020.
That's right.
Whether it's a message bill or not depends on whether you feel the sting from a rejected populace in the next election or whether you don't. And it depends on whether you're a person who took time and energy to see it pass and really felt that it was meaningful as opposed to just a message
bill. Do you guys want this to be a collective gripe, or do you want to go to quick gripes as we end the program?
No, I'm fine with that being a collective gripe. My gripe is that sometimes Brian's right and I never want to acknowledge it.
Brian, do you have a gripe you want to share?
The only gripe that I had is I want to hear more people saying, standing up and saying stuff that they really think. I'm looking at people who cave in and hold their tongues and pull their punches when they should be standing up and saying stuff about how they really feel about things because of people in power. So,
and the gripe I'm going to have is I'm bummed out that there's only two of these outstanding mayoral candidates that will go forward to the final election.
That's a fair gripe.
I would like to see three of them there.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Natalie Gochner. I've been joined by Dan McKay and Brian King. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks for listening.